Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to start the program today with a subject that we know will be challenging for many people. We want to talk about what is the right and fair way to treat the youngest violent offenders. We'd actually planned this conversation before the latest tragedy, the shooting just last night at a Washington State college campus that killed one and wounded three others. There was also the recent killing spree in Santa Barbara and a multiple stabbing at a Pennsylvania high school. But those crimes involved suspects who were teenagers and young adults. But a very disturbing assault this week in Wisconsin was allegedly carried out by middle school students. Authorities say two 12-year-old girls allegedly lured a friend into the woods and stabbed her 19 times. The victim, also a 12-year-old girl, survived the attack and she is recovering. The two suspects are now set to be tried in adult court. And this comes at a time when emerging science suggests that emotional maturity doesn't come until well after the teen years, some even argue into the early 20s. So we wanted to ask whether prosecuting children as adults makes sense, and if so, in what circumstances. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Professor Barry Feld. He is a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. He specializes in juvenile justice and the law. He also has a doctorate in sociology as well as his law degree, and he's with us from FE, Minnesota. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I do want to note that some other media outlets are using the girls' names, but we are not, and that is in accordance with NPR policy about minors. So, Professor, that being said, is there some general standard for when juveniles are charged as adults across the states?
Every state has its own juvenile code, and every juvenile code differs in terms of the types of children who will be transferred to criminal court and the process by which they would be transferred to criminal court.
So it varies widely?
It varies very widely. In most states, a judge would hold a hearing to determine whether or not a juvenile should be tried in juvenile court or in criminal court, and the criteria that judges use vary considerably. In a number of states, the prosecutor has discretion whether or not to charge a case directly in juvenile court or in criminal court, and in other states, the legislature has simply carved out of juvenile court jurisdiction certain categories of age and offense. Which is what makes the Wisconsin case interesting, because in Wisconsin, any child 10 years old or older must be charged in criminal court if they're charged with murder or attempted murder.
10 years old or older must be tried in adult court. So there was no discretion in this case.
That's right. The legislature has exercised its discretion to say that all you need to do is tell me that a kid is 10 or older and charged with murder, and they're an adult.
So how, just for people who are not, you know, familiar with this, because, and many people are not, because the juvenile system is closed, as you mentioned, in many places, what would be the difference? Can you just talk a little bit about how the juvenile processes or trial processes differ for juveniles than adult court? Do they get special consideration how they're treated, what kinds of witnesses, the kinds of processes that, as they unfold? What's different
about
it?
I mean, the main difference is that, well, juvenile courts by definition are created for children in recognition of the fact that children are different. And because children are different, juvenile courts are more oriented toward treating and rehabilitating and trying to change the life trajectory of young offenders. And so they have more resources, they will have more clinical support, at the end of the juvenile court's jurisdiction, a juvenile would be released, and the age of jurisdiction varies from states. And in some states it would be 18, in others 19 or 21. In Wisconsin it's 25. By contrast, if a person is tried as an adult, they can be executed, not juveniles, but can receive very, very long sentences, whereas the length of sentence in a juvenile court would be substantially shorter, especially for the most serious.
Can juveniles be executed in this country? If they commit a capital crime, what would be a capital crime for an adult, which is an intentional
Supreme Court,
act?
The Supreme Court has had three very important decisions. In 2005, in Roper v. Simmons, it abolished the death penalty for crimes committed by offenders under 18. In 2010, in Graham v. Florida, it abolished life without parole for non-homicide offenders. And in 2012, in Miller v. Alabama, it said that you cannot impose a mandatory life without parole on a juvenile who commits murder.
So if you're just joining us, we're talking about charging juveniles as adults. As you might imagine, we are motivated to talk about this because of the case of the two 12-year-old girls in Wisconsin who allegedly lured a friend into the woods and stabbed her multiple times. She survived and is recovering, and the two suspects are now set to be tried in adult court. In accordance with NPR policy, we are not naming those girls. I'd like to talk to go sort of beyond this, to talk about the adolescent brain more generally. Earlier this year, we spoke with Dr. Daniel Siegel, and he's the author of the book Brainstorm, where he talks about the, you know, the power and the purpose of the teenage brain. And he talks about how people generally kind of associate adolescence with hormonal changes, but the biggest changes, he says, are in the brain. And I just want to play a short clip from that conversation.
The way the brain is changing really is urging them to try new things, to have an emotional spark that pushes them forward, a social engagement with their peers, a search for novelty where they are going to be taking risks, which unfortunately involves danger.
Now, needless to say, Dr. Siegel does not know these girls. He did not treat them. He has not examined them and so forth. But I wanted to ask you, these two girls allegedly plotted this together. This was very much a planned act. And I'm just wondering how this fits into your understanding of how the violence involving juveniles, is that a common factor, and what might be motivating it?
Well, the adolescent brain is a work in progress, and especially for these very young offenders, they're really very, very different in terms of their risk assessment, appreciation of consequences, short-term versus long-term time perspective. It's a developmental process that the neuroscientists tell us now are not really completed until sometime in the early 20s. So especially for these very young kids, you know, they probably don't have what we would think of as mature judgment or impulse control. And the Supreme Court decisions I referred to earlier also emphasized the lack of self-control, the impulsivity, the vulnerability to peer influences. You know, significantly all the cases I described in this one involve multiple juveniles, so they almost goad each other on in ways that if they had been acting alone, the crime would never have occurred.
Now, these girls reportedly acted to please a fictional internet creature known as Slenderman. This according to interviews done with family members. You know, if this were an adult, one would say that there was mental competence issues involved. But with kids, as we know, they have sometimes a very different relationship with reality, you know, than adults do, that fictional characters can be quite real to them. And I wonder, how should the law recognize this? How does the law recognize that? Or does it?
Yeah. The first way the law recognizes it is by creating juvenile courts as an alternative to criminal courts, exactly because of differences in both cognitive understanding of reality as well as matters of self-control. That the juvenile court is an institution that recognizes the inherent immaturity of adolescents as a class. And so one of the provisions in the Wisconsin law is even if these girls are tried and convicted as adults, the criminal court would have the option of imposing a juvenile sentence and sending them back to juvenile court for more appropriate treatment than they would receive in the adult system.
Finally, actually, you know, I should ask you this at the outset. Do you have a personal opinion about either this case, recognizing that you have not been personally involved with it, but do you have a personal opinion about how this case is proceeding, or more generally, how children should be treated, even if they are accused of committing really heinous and egregious acts?
Sure. Well, it helps to put this case in context that murder or negligent homicide by children 12 or under accounts for about 1/10 of 1% of all of the homicide arrests. And in the 2012, in the FBI Uniform Crime Report, there were zero females 12 or under arrested for a homicide. So, you know, this is a very, very atypical kind of case. But there's nothing from what I've read in the newspaper articles about the case to suggest that the juvenile court is not the appropriate place to deal with these kinds of kids. Normally, when we transfer kids to criminal court, they're going to be older, 16 or 17-year-olds. They will have typically had some prior record of delinquency involvement. They would have had some kind of treatment exposure so that the system is sort of washing its hands of them. You know, by contrast, when you're dealing with such very young kids, there's absolutely no reason to think that anything good would happen with them in the adult system, and ample reason to think that the juvenile court can deal with whatever it is that brought them to the woods that day.
Professor Barry Feldes, Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. As we mentioned, he also has a doctorate in sociology and is a recognized authority in the area of juvenile justice and the law. We reached him in Effie, Minnesota. Professor Feld, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the World Cup starts next week in Brazil, but many residents of the normally soccer-mad nation are mad about something else. Huge cost overruns, transportation snafus, you name it. We'll find out why Brazilians aren't drinking the World Cup Kool-Aid. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
A sawmill worker named John Muir visited Alaska in 1879, and what he saw transformed him into a founder of American environmentalism.
Muir had no scientific credentials. The single greatest adventure he embarked upon in his entire life was this 40-day canoe journey to find the tidewater glaciers of Glacier Bay.
I'm Steve Kerwood, John Muir and the Ice That Started the Fire, next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Saturday evenings at 7 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's a part of the program where we talk about matters of religion and faith and spirituality. Today we want to talk about anti-Semitism, prejudice, or hatred toward Jewish people. The Anti-Defamation League recently surveyed people in 100 countries and estimated that more than a quarter of those people harbor anti-Semitic attitudes. That number is lower in the United States, but the group still found that 9%, nearly 1 in 10 Americans, have those views. Now many American Jews and others were alarmed by that number, but Rabbi Eric Yaffe says that that's the wrong message to take away from the survey. Rabbi Yaffe is president emeritus of the Union for Reform Judaism, and he recently wrote about his views for Time magazine online, and he is with us now to tell us more. Welcome, Rabbi Yaffe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And for those who are interested or concerned, I just do want to point out that we are having our conversation in advance of the Sabbath today. So having said all that, you wrote, quote, anti-Semitism is not a threat to the security and well-being of the Jews of America. Why do you say that, especially when the survey, if accurate, suggests that 1 in 10 Americans still holds anti-Semitic views?
Well, in the first place, the survey measures attitudes rather than behaviors. And attitudes are very, very difficult to measure. And also they use some methodologies, which in fact are very questionable, and there's been a lot of comment and criticism about those methodologies. And what's important really for American Jews is the security question, meaning can they go about their lives as individuals and as a community without running into ongoing discrimination and disruption? And what I was contending is, yes, they can. That's the American reality.
Why do you think it's important to point that out, to lift up that particular perspective?
Well, there's a lot to worry about in the world. I think the survey was helpful in that regard. Anti-Semitism is getting worse in Europe. It's a problem in the Muslim world and the Arab world in particular. And so there are real reasons of concern. But we really need to make distinctions. And I think American Jews were so distressed by what they read, my fear was that they really weren't understanding that America is different. And I wanted to bring that point home.
Let me just play a short clip from Abe Foxman, the director of the Anti-Defamation League. And these were some comments that he made in announcing the results of the survey. Here's what he said.
We also find that bigots don't believe that they are bigots. It means you ask people, are you favorable? And they say, yeah, some of my best friends are Jews. However, then you ask them about some of the stereotypes and they believe them and support them.
So, to that end, to the question of believe and support those stereotypes, I think the argument is that if you have certain beliefs, at some point you might act on them. You don't buy that?
Well, sometimes you might. Look, we have some very specific ways to measure anti-Semitism over the course of a modern Jewish history in particular. We ask the question, can Jews live in the neighborhoods they want to live in? Can they work anywhere, or is there discrimination when they try and enter certain industries? Are they able to go to any university that they want to go to? Those are the questions that we normally ask. All of those questions were a problem 50 or 60 years ago. None of them is a problem today. So, I think there'd be very few in the Jewish community who would dispute that fundamental fact.
Why do you think that some American Jews obsess about this question or are overly concerned, about this question? You address this in the piece. Do you have it in front of you? Do you want to read the line?
Well, look, we have a long history. We have 3 millennia during which Jews have often been victims and the objects of discrimination. Of course, the Holocaust was only 70 years ago. We live in the shadow of the Holocaust. That shapes our thinking. And then, as I said before, the situation in Europe is deeply disturbing. That's very real. It's getting worse. You have anti-Semitic parties that are currently functioning in Greece and in Hungary. And then, of course, you have the Jews' ongoing concern with the welfare of Israel. Israel is a country at war with her neighbors, and many of her neighbors want to exterminate her from the face of the earth. Those are all deeply disturbing things. So, of course, Jews are going to be concerned. But nonetheless, as I said, America is different. Our experience here is not what the experience is elsewhere. I think we need to understand and appreciate that. And then the other motivation that I have as a rabbi is a tremendous issue now for the Jewish community is how do we access the Jewish religious civilization from which we emerged and that really, really has sustained us for millennia, Jewish education, Jewish continuity. Sometimes we are distracted by an excessive concern about discrimination and anti-Semitism, with the result being that we don't focus on internal educational and religious revival issues that are essential for our survival.
You're constantly on a war footing, perhaps, not taking care of
matters
here at home.
That can be a danger here in America, and I wanted to point that out.
You pointed out that you're concerned about the methodology of the survey, though. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? I mean, is it because of the kinds of questions or statements that were deemed to be inherently anti-Semitic, or were there other things that concerned you?
Well, the survey put out 11 statements about Jews, 11 prejudices, and then you were asked whether or not they were true. And if you said six were probably true, six out of the 11, you were then categorized as anti-Semitic or infected with anti-Semitism. But it's a problematic methodology from many perspectives. The index that they use was created 50 years ago, slightly revised, but whether it currently applies now at all. It has no way of taking into account ambiguity. It can't measure intensity. In other words, someone has strong prejudices against Jews in two or three areas and just mild feelings in other areas, they won't be considered anti-Semitic. And some of the questions I think were simply asked wrong. In other words, if you say, do Jews have too much power? Americans don't like power. You know, 20 to 25% may say yes. But if you ask the question the way it should be asked, which is, which of the following groups has too much power? And then you list a whole range of groups, banks, labor unions, blacks, the Catholic Church, WASPs. Under those circumstances, the number of people who say that Jews have too much power will be cut in half. So, look, the ADL is a wonderful organization. They do great educational work here. That's very, very important to remember. But this particular survey, I think, was really done in the wrong way.
Well, you know, the Anti-Defamation League also releases an annual audit of anti-Semitic incidents, and it tracked 751 incidents across the U.S. during the 2013 calendar year. I think the one that may stand out for some people is that last April, three people were killed in a shooting outside Jewish facilities in Overland Park, Kansas. So that is behavior. How would
that,
you...
That is behavior. Yeah. It's absolutely behavior. One anti-Semitic act is too many. We ought to be clear on that. Nonetheless, we have to recognize, first of all, there's always going to be anti-Semitism. It never disappears from the human heart. I mean, we need to understand and appreciate that. But most of the incidents that we talk about are acts of individuals on the fringe, desecrating cemeteries and those kinds of things. And while they're disturbing and must be watched, they don't make anti-Semitism a major problem in America. They don't make America an anti-Semitic country.
If you could be the rabbi of the country and help shape people's thinking about this, what would you wish people to be thinking about, you know, going forward?
Discrimination and prejudice are a problem. They're a problem for Jews and for many other groups. We have to work on intergroup conflict. We need ongoing education. On the other hand, we don't want in any way to exaggerate what is there. We need to recognize the wonderful nature of this extraordinary country in which we live. And that needs to be the context in which we fight the prejudices that exist.
Rabbi Eric Yaffe is president emeritus of the Union for Reformed Judaism. His piece for Time Magazine Online is titled "Anti-Semitism, Not a Threat to American Jews," and we reached him in Boston. Rabbi, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Good to be with you.
Switching gears now, let's talk World Cup. Every 4 years, people around the world tune into the same thing at the same time over the same 4 weeks. They're watching the World Cup. This year's tournament will be held in Brazil, and the first match between Brazil and Croatia is just 6 days away. Although the games start next week, the tournament has been getting much attention for what's going on outside the huge soccer stadiums around the country, which is huge demonstrations, as well as what's going on inside those stadiums, because some still are not ready. And a transit strike started in Sao Paulo on Thursday. NPR South America correspondent Lourdes Garcia Navarro is in Brazil, and she's been following the lead up to the tournament and all that's going on inside and outside the stadiums. And she's with us now from Sao Paulo. Lourdes, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, it seems like every big international event in recent years, there have been complaints and concerns, but these seem as massive as the tournament itself. I mean, we've been hearing that construction of stadiums and airports and even cell phone networks for all the people coming in to watch the games might not be ready. Is this true or not?
I think it is true. I think it's been pretty glaring what's been happening here. And I think for those of us who live in Brazil, it's not surprising because the cell phone networks have never been particularly good and the banking system hasn't been great if you have foreign cards. And so all these things that are now getting a lot of scrutiny have been sort of facts of daily life for Brazilians and expats who live here for a long time. Certainly, though, the big news is what's happening at the stadiums, outside the stadiums, as you mentioned, things are just not ready. And it's really chaotic. I mean, just here today in São Paulo, Brazil's largest city, the place where the World Cup will literally kick off next week, we're seeing a strike by metro workers, which has paralyzed the city's transportation. So we're just seeing epic traffic jams. Buses are overcrowded. We've even seen soccer's governing body, FIFA, officials taking 3 hours to get to their hotels from the airport. So it's even tough for people at the top right now.
How long should it take to get to the airport?
It depends where you're going. But from the airport to the center of the city, it should take about 45 minutes to an hour. So that's triple what we're seeing. It's really, really bad out there today.
So is there a plan for dealing with the transportation? How are they going to? It's conceivable that teams couldn't get to the stadiums on time for their matches. What are they going to do?
We've had strikes pretty consistently for the past few months. People realize this is the time to pretty much shake down the government. And it's been successful. The federal police, after threatening to strike during the World Cup, got a 16% raise. Bus drivers got a 10% raise. So we are expecting that the metro workers will also be given a raise because certainly the government does not want the main way people are going to get to the stadium here in São Paulo to be shut down. So we are expecting that some deal will be reached, but the metro workers are standing firm. People are thinking that it's kind of Christmas come early here. People are really using the World Cup to get some of the things that they have wanted for some time from the government.
Is there a sense of that this is going to be a helpful thing for the economy?
That is such a big question. I think that's something that's racking, you know, host countries all over the world because it's a subject of great debate. Do these mega sporting events actually bring the benefits that people say that they do? Is there going to be an influx of tourist dollars? Absolutely. Is there going to be money spent here? Absolutely. But will that offset the massive costs? This is the most expensive World Cup ever staged. We are seeing an economy that is stagnant right now. As you mentioned, there's going to be less than 2% growth. It's forecasted this year. Prices are really high. Inflation is over 6%. People are very unhappy. And will the World Cup give that a boost? I mean, it's only a month of spending and they've just, you know, overspent on these stadiums and on these infrastructure projects. And so people are saying, hey, at the end of the day, really, is it worth it for us to come and host, to have been the hosts of this event? A lot of people are coming down on the side saying no.
I want to hear more about the mood. First of all, I think most people who follow the sport know that Brazil is soccer mad. They are dominant.
Crazy.
Soccer crazy. They're dominant in the sport. Oh, I was trying to be classy about it. That's why I said soccer mad. But they're dominant in the sport. They're expected to do well. Are people excited about that aspect of it? Or is all these other issues, you know, the spending, the disruption, is that taking a damper off people's feelings about this?
A lot of people talk about the schizophrenic mood of Brazil right now. So on the one hand, you know, you have all these people who, of course, love their national team. Once the ball gets rolling, we'll be behind Brazil 110%. But I don't think that that does take away from the fact that people are upset about what's happened here. And there's many reasons for that. Certainly, they are embarrassed by the fact that on the world stage now, this was supposed to be a big shining moment for Brazil. It was supposed to be the moment where Brazil showed that it could be a member of the global community, and it was right up there with developed nations. And in fact, what's happened is that the glaring inequality here, the inefficiencies here, have really come to the forefront. So many of the people that I've spoken to say that they do feel ashamed, and their mood is not terribly bright. We saw a recent poll that showed that 70% of people feel the country is going in the wrong direction. 60% of people now feel that hosting the World Cup was a mistake. Those are pretty big numbers.
And speaking of which, you know, speaking of numbers, Brazil has a presidential election coming up in October. Do you think that these next few weeks will have an impact on how those elections proceed? Are candidates, for example, taking using what's going on with World Cup as part of their campaigns?
Absolutely. Everyone says that this is going to have massive repercussions. I mean, this is a huge moment for the government. If everything goes well, people say it will be a boost for Dilma Rousseff and her re-election campaign if it goes badly. They say it could go very badly for her at the polls come October. Right now, in a recent poll, we've seen her numbers going down from 37% approval rating to 34% approval rating. Those are pretty dismal numbers. The mood here is not very happy.
Lourdes, before we let you go, can I ask you, why are these stadiums so expensive? I mean, you reported, for example, that the Corinthians Arena, which is where the opening match will be played, it's in Sao Paulo. It's going to be handed over to the football club, you know, after the games are over. But you reported that it costs $450 million. Why?
They're magnificent. They're sort of really gorgeous places to go and watch a football match. But ultimately, they're just stadiums. And I think that's what's behind a lot of the protests. People say, why? And of course, there will be an accounting at the end, but delays, cost overruns because of striking workers and having to give them more money, inflation. Everyone feels there was a lot of corruption here involved in these stadiums because they shouldn't have cost this much.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro is NPR South America correspondent. She was with us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Lourdes, thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
You're welcome.
Coming up, was it the heat that took down the Miami Heat last night? A faulty air conditioning system spiked temperatures as the San Diego Spurs took game one of the NBA Finals.
I think all of us were feeling the heat. We're all dehydrated. We played through it, found a way to win.
The Barbershop Guys weigh in on the series and other news of the week. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com/NPR. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at Edutopia.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Oh, no, you do not want to fight with me right now, crazy.
I don't want to fight you. I want to end you right now.
Netflix's dramatic comedy about a women's prison, Orange is the New Black, is returning for a second season. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear interviews with Jenji Kohan, who created the series, and Piper Kerman, whose memoir about being locked up inspired the show. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I bet you never heard of self-healing concrete.
There's bacteria that are put inside the concrete, and they can lie dormant for 50 years.
I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday as we talk about the amazing materials around us. Plus, will the EPA's climate plan lead to real environmental change? All on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel, with us from Cleveland. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant, a contributor to National Review Online, with us from Boston. Sports writer and journalism professor Kevin Blackstone is here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Corey Dade, contributing editor for The Root. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas.
What's happening?
Hey, Jimmy.
1-2, 1-2, and welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Great.
What up, though? What up, though?
Hashtag Bismarcky reference. All right, well, let's get things started. You know, the San Antonio Spurs put the Miami Heat on a low simmer last night. Oh. They took game one of the finals 110-95. It was kind of like playing in your old high school gym. An air conditioning failure kind of led to 90-degree temperatures inside the AT&T Center. Dr. Neil, LeBron couldn't take the heat. He cramped out. Poor baby. What's up with that, though?
So, I mean, cramps are actually really serious. And I think
sure
the problem
are.
With LeBron and these things isn't that he cramped up or he had a problem. It's those incredibly exaggerated facial distress signals that he sends out, whether it's a cramp or a call he disagrees with. There's always something. But, you know, the game reminded me yesterday of growing up and the old Boston Garden and the Lakers and the Celtics back in the day. And, you know, I want to thank the ghost of Red Auerbach for cutting the air conditioning and reminding us what basketball was like back then.
Oh, that
indeed.
Is like, well, that's what just kills me, that people talking about that's part of the game. Like, Corey, what is up with that? What is that?
Mark Jackson, who is the color commentary commentator during the game, said this is part of the game. It's like, no, it's not. No, it's not. It's indoors. That's football. You know, football, that the climate is not part of the game in basketball. Okay, let's just get that clear. You know, but
I don't know.
It's not. But it was last night. But that's the only the only way you're going to stop LeBron.
Well, can we hear what the Miami Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra had to say about the whole situation? Can anybody want to hear that?
Yeah,
I want to hear it. Yeah,
sure.
Let's drop that, please.
I think it felt like a punch in the gut when you see your leader limping like that back to the bench. But at the same time, we still had an opportunity to make plays going down the stretch, and they made obviously the biggest plays in the last 5 minutes.
Just like a punch in the gut, ladies and gentlemen.
Of course. Are you talking about LeBron leaving Cleveland, or are you talking about last night?
I think a little Cleveland haterade is coming out.
I don't even remember that LeBron was even in Cleveland. He was actually inaccurate. Get your maps out, ladies and gentlemen. Get your maps out.
You dream about him. Don't even like it. You dream about him.
Kevin Blackstone, you got something for us? Come on, KB.
Oh, that was such history. Look, I mean, what a bizarre end to that game. You know, and LeBron left. They had a lead. He's such a good player in the last few minutes of a game. I think that clearly turned the game. And now, so you've got all this drama. All I know is if I'm running the San Antonio Spurs arena, I don't call the air conditioning man just yet. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. Don't call him just yet.
Okay, well, you know, look, you guys, you know I don't care much for hockey. I don't understand why you could even play hockey in June. I mean, next thing you'll...
sport, Jimmy.
Well,
Michelle, just thought we'd mention it. Like, oh, right, basketball. Just thought I'd mention
baseball
it.
Baseball in October?
Michelle, next thing you'll be telling me there's a Jamaican bobsled team. But you're excited about the Stanley Cup, man. So jump in here, KB.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, if you loved the East Coast rap, West Coast rap feud back in the 80s and 90s, then you got to love this because it's New York, L.A., come on. Mm-hmm. And they put on a great performance in Game 1, went into overtime, was decided by a turnover and a great goal. You've got two great goaltenders, Quick with L.A. and Lundqvist with New York. And I think it's something that that people can embrace. It's a lot of fun. And L.A. Kings are one of these resilient teams that have won. They won three consecutive Game 7s on the road to advance to the Stanley Cup. So I think it's pretty exciting stuff. Come on over.
Hey, bro. Neil Minkoff, you like hockey. Who are you rooting for, man?
So I'm rooting for the Rangers. I love that they have some great backstories. You know, a couple of players who have gotten the team to dedicate the season or at least the playoff run to some unfortunate family deaths. They have a fantastic goalie in King Henrik, and they're a fun team to watch. incredibly disappointed that the Bruins didn't make it there. But the Rangers are really, you know, they've really reignited hockey in New York. And that could be the key to making hockey a little more mainstream nationwide.
Yeah,
I just think so stand-up of Boston guy to root for any New York team. Neil, I salute you.
It is impressive.
I salute you.
I hear Corey Date over there. Yeah. Corey, can you name one player on either team?
Well, Quick, the goalie. Yeah. I was just
going
to do
name?
That. Quick. His name is Quick.
Okay.
wait. Is that what his mama calls him? Does his mama call him Quick?
If mama call him Quick, I'm going to call him Quick. No, I like the fact that you have two big major markets, U.S. markets. Usually there's a Canadian team against an American team, but I like that you have two big markets because the sport really does need to grow in the U.S. And I will tell you, Jimmy, if you ever go to a hockey game live, you will become a believer. You got to see
it live. All right, man. Mm-hmm. Well, hit them up. Hashtag Tupac reference.
If you just joined us, we are having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, sports writer Kevin Blackstone, journalist Corey Date, and healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Michelle.
So different topic here, obviously. This is a much different topic, you know, switching gears here.
Of course. You know, the Obama administration is explaining why they traded five Taliban members for service member Bo Bergdahl, who had been held in Afghanistan since 2009, but not everyone is welcoming him home, Michelle.
It's been interesting because I have to confess that this is not a story that, you know, I had followed closely, and I didn't realize that there was so much resentment about this among the people with whom he served. Like other soldiers, for example, are very angry. Here's a quote from a retired Army specialist, Sam Masamitsu, talking about this, his former soldier with whom he served. So,
I think that he should be tried as a deserter and court-martialed. I would personally like to see him in Leavenworth through the remainder of his days. I would like to see him give a formal apology to us, his unit, and the families of those lost.
The argument being that other soldiers have died trying to rescue him, but the fact is it is not clear what the circumstances are of how Bergdahl was separated from his unit. It suggests that he walked away, but he has not formally been declared a deserter. And so it's a very complicated story. So, Jimmy, I'm interested in all of your take on this because I'm wondering if there's kind of a gender piece to this, too, because I haven't heard any women talk about how they don't think he should have been rescued. All the women that I recognize anecdotes are dangerous, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are about this.
Well, first off, I want to give props to the men and women serving to protect our country because that's what's up. And the other thing is the whole trade thing was kind of weird to me. It's like so he looks bad in the video, so he looks a little despondent. And one white boy with the sniffles is worth five Taliban. That trade didn't work for me. I'm sorry. I mean, it just didn't work for me.
What's the race aspect of it? He's an American soldier serving his uniform. So I don't know whether – so if it was a black guy in the sniffles that you should – you see my point? I don't get the racial aspect of it.
Shoshana,
he's wearing the uniform of the United States representing
When Shoshana and Jessica Lynch were over there, I mean, we sent people to get them, but we didn't offer up a trade. And they were hurt. They were verifiably shot. You know, so I don't know that there is a race aspect to it. It just disturbed me to see that trade just doesn't work, you know, for me. And if he did something he wasn't supposed to do, then yes, he should be brought up on charge. That's how I feel.
Uh-huh.
Corey Date?
Well, first of all, prisoner swaps are standard fare in war. I mean, let's just be clear about that. The U.S. was going to have to release these detainees in Gitmo anyway because they were not prosecutable under civilian courts or in military courts. And with the war winding down, that is what happens. So, you know, the Republicans make a false equivalency between sort of five, you know, the Taliban detainees are not equivalent to, you know, are excessive for one U.S. soldier. I think, and also more than anything, though, if you believe in the American ethic of leave no soldier behind, which up until recently every Republican did and they accepted, then you have to accept that what Obama did was the right thing. Now, that ethic has nothing to do with whether or not Bergdahl was a deserter. Let the process figure that out. And what I thought was interesting is over the last day or so, Republicans are starting to back up now. They were on it. They were criticized. Now they're backing up. And Raul Labrador, congressman, Tea Party congressman from Idaho, that is Bergdahl's home state, he would normally be one of the people clamoring to criticize the president. He's not. He's saying the most important thing here is we need to be thankful he's back home on U.S. soil. So let's go with that and worry about the questions of his wandering off his post later. Let's deal with that, but not right now. And I think that's the right approach.
Neil, what do you think?
So a couple of things. First of all, allow me to be the 18 millionth person to say that this reminds me way too much of Homeland. I think that actually has affected the coverage and the discussion of what's going on. The press conference celebration in the Rose Garden was awfully odd and probably led to a lot of the questions and the brushback that's been occurring since, with a lot more questions about exactly how this young man fell into captivity. But I agree that the time, what I think we need is, if we're going to send five of these Gitmo detainees back into a theater where there's the potential for them to re-engage, then I think we need an explanation as to how that decision was reached and why it was considered to be the proper decision. I'm not saying it wasn't the right decision, but I'm saying that I think that we need more transparency.
Kevin, what do you think?
Well, you know, I've tried to look beyond this. I mean, one thing we know for sure is that he was a prisoner of war. And I agree fully with Corey and those who say that you leave no soldier behind. I've just been interested in the politicization of all of this. And I'm also wondering, you know, so what is the administration up to here? You're pulling out of Afghanistan. You know that the Afghanistan that's going to be there after you've left is not going to be in Afghanistan. You really want it to be there. But you're going to have to deal with them as a player on the world stage. The Taliban, as repugnant as they may be, are people that you're going to have to deal with. And this was so I look at this as some sort of diplomatic effort, some sort of, not necessarily an olive branch, but trying to deal with this government or governing body in some sort of diplomatic terms. And so that's kind of the way I'm looking at it and see what goes beyond that. And the other thing is, it always strikes me when we talk about Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, is everyone that the U.S. kills and everyone that they capture a high-ranking Taliban or Al-Qaeda official? Are there no privates in these organizations? It is amazing. Everyone, it seems, plays some incredibly important role in destroying the rest of the world. And I'm hard-pressed to believe that.
Just a quick question for Corey, because you've written before about how you feel like this administration, is interesting how there's such a contrast between their skill at communicating during elections and their failure at it while governing on issues of governance. I mean,
it's amazing.
You're saying that the optics, you think they mismanaged the conversation around
over
it, and like
and
how
over
so?
Over and over.
Well, in this
especially,
instance, in this, in this instance,
in
tell
this
me how.
In this instance, they knew what was going on. So they know Bergdahl's record, okay? He didn't just wander off his post this time. He did it before in California, okay? That's something that they know. They can look at that and they can game plan and they can say there's that issue. There's the issue of the law requiring the president to notify Congress anytime Gitmo prisoners would be released. And then you look at sort of the optics of Bergdahl's father and what he tweeted and the fact that he learned the language of Afghans and he grew the beard. And so all their, you know, PR people and the political people can sit there and game plan out and strategize what are our talking points around that. And it wasn't good. And Susan Rice on Sunday, she came out and she called Bergdahl a soldier who served with distinction and honor. Those two things sent off red flags to the other side, to the adversaries. And to me, the White House could have easily come up with stronger messaging around that, to at least come up with, to Neil's point, a little bit more transparency that would explain why they're doing this.
Or not invite the parents there and make it
that
an opportunity
too.
To elevate this.
You know, yeah, they got their arms
like,
around each
that?
Other.
Yeah. That was an interesting, All right, well, interesting perspective. Okay, one more topic. Just wanted to throw this out there. We only have a couple of minutes left, but it's been a week when a trio of celebrities have been on the sorry circuit. You know, Jonah Hill offered a public apology after making a homophobic slur to a member of the paparazzi who were following him, singer Pharrell. Donned this feather headdress on the UK cover of Elle magazine. And then there was this video of a 14-year-old Justin Bieber. Do you have time to play it? Can we just play it? Here it is.
If I kill you, I'll be part of the KKK. that there'll be one less lonely nigga. There'll gonna be one less lonely nigga.
All right, so he's 14, but, you know, so I just wanted to ask each of you which gets your ugh and which one's just, you know, shrug. Kevin, you want to start?
Well, the ugh for me is Pharrell Williams, mm-hmm. because right now he's on top of the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sitting here in Washington, D.C., where we have the ongoing debate over mascotting of Native Americans, Native peoples in this country, and how their images are used, misused, misappropriated. And for him to go on a cover wearing a headdress, which is a mm-hmm. sacred garment, is disturbing to me. And it's disturbing to me that that black folks who should be racially sensitive are, in fact, racially insensitive.
Mm-hmm. Corey, ugh or shrug, which one gets yours?
I get a shrug for Justin Bieber. I mean, if my 9-year-old can figure out that he's not worth paying attention to, that he's whack,
okay.
then we all should. I mean, you know, he broke the law already. Why hasn't he been deported yet? What's going on?
Oh, stop it. Okay. Okay. Back to Canada. Okay, Neil, what about you? Quick.
For me, the biggest ugh was the Jonah Hill one, and it wasn't so much the slur. It was the way the slur was used. Mm-hmm. To where he basically used sexual imagery and a sexual act or describing a sexual act as a weapon and made it a way of demeaning somebody and made it almost violent. And I found that to be the biggest ugh of them all.
Hmm. All right, Jimmy, final word?
Big shrug to Pharrell and the headdress. He's an artist. He gets to express himself with the tools he has available. That's what art is. And it's a commentary. It's provocative. Drink it in. Love it. Take a picture. Move on.
Okay. Wow. Send the letters to Jimmy Israel. He is a writer.
That's right. JimmyIsrael@gmail.com.
JimmyIsrael.com. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to the National Review. He'll be treating Jimmy after this. Kevin Black is known as a sports columnist, a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Corey Dade is a contributing editor for The Root. He also runs their political blog, The Take. Thank you all so much.
Yes, sir.
See
ya. Hey.
Yup.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast that's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.